As everybody in this room knows, living cells are made of atoms, which in turn are made of so-called elementary particles, referred to as the electron, the proton, and the neutron. Now, the quantum field theories, which we so successfully use to describe the world of the elementary particles, demand that for every particle, for every kind of particle, there is a corresponding antiparticle. So for the electron, which is negatively charged, there is the positron, which is positively charged. For the proton, there is an antiproton, which is negatively charged. And for the neutron, there is an antineutron. The comparison between a particle and an antiparticle is this. They have exactly the same mass. If either spins like a little top, and all of these do, then the corresponding antiparticle also spins like a little top in precisely the same way. If the particle is electrically charged, then the corresponding antiparticle has an exactly equal but opposite electric charge. And finally, if the particle has no charge, like the neutron, that's why it's called neutron, it's neutral. Nevertheless, if it bears some charge-like attribute, then the antiparticle will bear an exactly equal and opposite amount of that attribute. So in the case of the neutron, it bears an attribute called nucleon number, or sometimes baryon number. It has a nucleon number of plus one, so the n bar has a nucleon number of minus one. Now, when a particle and its opposite number, its antiparticle, collide, they can annihilate one another, and out will come stuff that bears no relation to what went in. For example, electron and positron can annihilate, leaving behind just electromagnetic energy. The reason they can do that is that whatever charge this has an exactly opposite charge. Electric charge is conserved, but no charge when you add these two things together is coming in. So electric charge is conserved, and we can have nothing but energy at the end. Now, this possibility of annihilation has a very important implication for living things. You are made of electrons, protons, and neutrons. If you were to walk into a cloud of antimatter, you would quickly go poof. The particles in the anti-cloud would annihilate the particles in your body, and that would be the end of both of you. If you were to encounter a spitting image of yourself walking down the street, but made of antimatter instead of matter, it would not be a very good idea to try to shake the hand of that person. You would annihilate each other. Consequently, the existence of life depends on the fact that the universe contains matter, these particles which are familiar to us and of which we are made, but very little antimatter. There is a matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. Were it not so, then we would just get annihilated.
Okay, would that mean to say that there's more matter than antimatter?
Yes. Exactly. Exactly.
Or is the best limit still from Everett, from GeV photons, non-observational domain? This old paper by
my questioner, herein after referred to as naysayer. Oh, hi, Alex.
there was an old paper analyzing how much antimatter we have.
What we really know is that locally there is more matter than antimatter. There is the possibility, that's the possibility that Alex is raising, that the universe contains, for example, exactly as much matter as it does antimatter, but the matter is here and the antimatter is there. And they don't annihilate because they don't meet. There are limits on that, but they're not constraining. And for example, there was a conference a little less than a year ago on matter-antimatter asymmetry in which this possibility that they're separated in space was very much alive and discussed. So I think it's still a possibility in principle, but the theoretical prejudice, for want of a better word, is that this did not happen and that the universe is actually matter dominated. It contains more matter than antimatter, rather than having regions where it's one way and another region where it's the other way.
That separation could not have occurred causally in the universe.
Well, this separation was described in this conference to which I refer as baryon symmetric, or BS in short.
See a lot of GeV photons if that was the case. And I think the limit is actually fairly strong. I don't remember what exactly it is.
Well, I'm happy to assume that this is the situation. More matter than antimatter. Now, the universe, as you know, was born exactly 13.7 plus or minus 0.2 billion years ago, plus 10 minutes now. In a hot Big Bang, when the temperature was very high, the energies, the average energies of particles were very large, essentially anything could have been, anything that exists was made. And then it gradually cooled. Symmetry suggests that the hot Big Bang created equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And even if that were not the case, were there ever an era of thermal equilibrium, any imbalance between matter and antimatter would have been equilibrated out, and you would have been left with equal amounts of matter and antimatter. But that is not what we see today. We see more matter than antimatter, and consequently, we have to understand how this asymmetry on which our existence depends developed. Now, for this asymmetry, that matter is much more abundant than antimatter, to develop subsequent to the Big Bang, assuming that you start from equal amounts of the two, it must be the case that matter, particles of matter, behave differently in some way than particles of antimatter. This is very easy to understand in a hand-waving way. If you start with equal amounts of particles and their antiparticles, and the particles and the antiparticles behave in exactly the same way, then you're going to continue to have equal amounts of the two. You will not generate this asymmetry that we see today. Let me give you a semi-quantitative example of that. Suppose that in the early universe, there were made some particles X, which are electrically charged, and we're assuming that everything was initially matter-antimatter symmetric, so there would have been equal numbers of X positively charged particles and their antiparticles, the X negatively charged ones. And suppose that one source of protons was that these X pluses decayed into protons plus other stuff, while correspondingly the X minuses decayed into antiprotons plus other stuff. If particles and antiparticles behave in exactly the same way, that would mean, among other things, that the rate at which this process happens and the rate at which that process happens are identical. That has the consequence that if you start with equal numbers of these particles, you wind up with equal numbers of those particles, contrary to what we observe today. So if you want to wind up with fewer p-bars than p's, it must be the case that somewhere along the line, particles behave differently than antiparticles.
Is it not possible to have spontaneously breaking up this symmetry?
Well, but you're still breaking it, somehow. That's fine.
Just how large is this asymmetry?
How large is the asymmetry?
Yeah. Is it a huge discrepancy?
It depends how you measure that. And perhaps somebody who's an astrophysicist knows the numbers better than I do, like Alex, for example. How many electrons are there?
Well, the ratio of the symmetry, the number of variance to photon.
I don't want
to
know that number. This questioner would like to know how many positrons there are relative to the number of electrons.
Well, it depends where. You mean, near
the early universe?
No, but near a star.
Today.
Near a star or a black hole, you get a lot of pair production. Yeah, when matter falls
into No. But that's an exceptional point.
So, okay, it's a temperature, right? If you can use the
zero.
Zero.
Okay. The simple answer is there's zero antimatter. Thank you, Gary. It's a very big asymmetry. Now, this realization that matter and antimatter must behave, or let me put it, that particles and antiparticles must behave differently,
I must say this is amusing because a biologist would not have concluded this rapidly that the fact that most chiral biological molecules are left-handed means that parity is violated in chemistry.
we're coming to handedness. Yeah, that's actually a very interesting thing to consider. I banged my head against the wall for a while on Saturday, and then I decided to drop it.
Why is this the conclusion?
This is the conclusion because if it were not so, if you start with equal...
Millions of experiments, then of course, in average, you would find out you get both realizations. But if you get the symmetry breaks by some reason, you know, it's just a bifurcation. You know, bifurcating the one path. We only see one path, but that doesn't mean that they behave differently. It just means you've chosen the one path.
It could be a rare occurrence.
I guess that's true.
That is a possibility. But
no, what do you mean by different path? You mean they behave differently.
This doesn't work in a universe with large numbers, but it would work in a universe with small numbers. You could have a decay which yields either a particle or it yields an antiparticle, and if only that one decay occurs, it yields one or it yields the other, not both, and you have generated a very large asymmetry even though there is no intrinsic asymmetry to begin with. That's the kind of possibility that you're raising. But we're talking, yeah. That's natural selection. You have five experiments, but the results of four of them die off. But we're talking about a universe where the numbers of events of any given type are very, very large. And so those kinds of fluctuations would disappear.
And so we know the correlation length. We say we actually have the correlation length is large enough so that there are no other regions that behave totally differently. Because we don't know that.
That we don't know, but that's the BS model.
Right, so.
Those regions have to be very far away because at the interface of matter-antimatter region, there would be some annihilation going on. And people have calculated the flux from the interfaces of these matter-antimatter regions that would exceed the Edward bound on GV photons. By many orders of magnitude,
right.
Unless the closest domain of antimatter is very, very remote.
He's not saying your possibility couldn't have happened. He's saying the evidence is that it didn't. Okay, so the conclusion then is that particles and antiparticles must behave differently. Consequently, it's very interesting to study the elementary particles in the laboratory and see whether they do behave differently. Well, let us consider for a moment something called the pi meson. That's a particle that contributes to the nuclear force, which binds the nuclei of atoms together. There are two electrically charged pi mesons, one positive and its antiparticle, which is negative. And the pi plus disintegrates into another particle, which is called the mu plus, and a neutrino of the same kind of flavor, as it's called, as this muon. So it's a muon neutrino. The details of these particles aren't important to us. What is important is how the corresponding antiparticles behave. The pi minus decays to a mu minus. That's the antiparticle of this muon. And an antineutrino, which is the antiparticle of this neutrino. It is observed that when these particles emerge, each of them spins like a little top, and the spin angular momentum vector points opposite to the momentum vector. What this means is that if you curl the fingers of your left hand around the momentum vector, that's the way in which the muon is spinning. In contrast, it is observed that in this decay, the spins are opposite. Now you have to curl the fingers of your right hand around the momentum vector so that your fingers are spinning the way the muon is spinning. So evidently, in some way, a pi plus and a pi minus decaying into mu and nu, or their antiparticles, behave differently. But this is not enough. If you measure the rates at which these processes occur, you find that the rates are identical. So yes, there's a difference between particles and antiparticles. They make tops that spin in the opposite way, but the rates at which they do that are not different. And what we are trying to explain in the end is a dominance of particles over antiparticles, and we demand that these rates be different. Indeed, the observation that these two rates are the same led people many years ago to an hypothesis, which is that if you reflect the world both by reflecting the charges, turning an electrically charged particle into one of opposite charge, and reflecting it through a mirror so that a particle which is spinning like this starts spinning the opposite way, then the laws of physics are invariant. And that is called CP invariance, and it stands for charge conjugation, which means you reverse the charges of all the particles, replacing particles by their antiparticles when they're neutral, times parity, which means, roughly speaking, that you reflect the world through a mirror so that the spins like this become the spins like that. And the hypothesis for some time was that the world was CP invariant, and that would have been sufficient to guarantee that these two rates are equal, and that any such rates like this are equal as well, because now we're not asking which way is the proton or the antiproton spinning. We're only asking what are these rates, and if CP invariance holds, these two rates would be equal. Then in the 60s, it was found that this symmetry between particle and antiparticle is violated. And I will refer to that as a crossed out CP. And the discovery was this. There is a particle called the K long. Long means it has a very long lifetime, about 10 to the minus 7 seconds. We wouldn't call that long, but the kaon does. And it disintegrates after some 10 to the minus 7 seconds into one of these guys, a pion, an electron, and this time an electron neutrino. The neutrino always is of the same persuasion as the electrically charged particle it comes with. I guess this is an anti-electron neutrino. And the matter-antimatter image of this decay is pi plus replaced by its antiparticle of pi minus, electron replaced by its antiparticle of positron, and the antineutrino replaced by its antiparticle, a neutrino. And roughly speaking, the particle-antiparticle image of a K-long is also a K-long. This particle is not different from its antiparticle. And there are some other examples of such objects. The photon, the particle of which a light beam is made, is another example, a particle which is the same as its antiparticle. But most of them are different.
How could they be the same if they disintegrate in different ways?
Yes. Very good question. It's not that they disintegrate in different ways. It's that one and the same particle typically has various ways in which it can disintegrate. And once it will disintegrate this way, another time it will disintegrate that way. And this particle disintegrates sometimes this way, and sometimes that way, and sometimes other ways, which I'm not even listing. But these two modes are very interesting to compare because they are exactly particle, antiparticle, mirror images of one another. So the question is, do they have the same rate? And the answer is no. To be sure, the difference is not enormous. It's only about 0.3%. But it's non-zero. So nature violates CP. Nature does distinguish between the behavior of particles and antiparticles. So at least the possibility of generating this matter-antimatter asymmetry is there. But this difference between how particles and antiparticles behave is very small. Why so small? And can we find bigger ones? Incidentally, the question you raised in another guise was the subject of a very famous puzzle called the Tau Theta puzzle about a half a century ago when people had two particles, or so they thought, the tau and the theta, and the difference ones, one decayed one way and another decayed another way, and it was odd that they had exactly the same mass as each other, but people were very reluctant to suppose they're the same particle for exactly the reason you said. How can one particle decay? How can this particle be the same as that particle? That's the way you put it, if they decay in different ways. Well, they were the same particle, and they just have the opportunity to decay sometimes this way and sometimes that way.
And it's the top one that's favored in this case?
I don't even remember. Yeah, I don't know. I looked it up on Saturday, actually, and I couldn't find it in my handy-dandy. I don't know. This is a very small difference in any case. I'm going to get to some bigger differences where I will know the answer. Okay. So, why so small? To at least understand that a little bit, we have to talk about the constituents of matter, or at least the constituents of some matter. These are the so-called quarks and the leptons. So how do I want to tabulate this? Yeah. We've been talking about the electron. There are three electron-like particles. In addition to the electron, there is the mu, which we have also mentioned, and then there is the tau. Each of these is, roughly speaking, a carbon copy of the electron, but heavier. This one is about 200 times heavier than an electron, and this is something like 18 times heavier than a muon, roughly. But in other respects, they're the same. Corresponding to these three particles, there are neutrinos. There's one that goes with the electron, one with a muon, and one with a tau. And then there are things called quarks, of which the proton and the neutron are made, and also this K meson, and also the pion, and many other particles. And there are six kinds of quarks. They are called up and down, charmed and strange, truthful and beautiful. Well, let me give you a table of the electric charges. I'll do it over here. These are the electric charges in units of the charge on a proton. This is minus one. These are electrically neutral. This is plus two-thirds, and this is minus a third. And for example, a proton consists of two up quarks and a down quark bound together. And you see the electric charges are such that you get two-thirds plus two-thirds for the two up quarks, minus a third for the down quark, adding up to one. So the proton has a unit of one charge in units of the proton charge. And a neutron is the same thing, except with the roles of up and down interchanged. So two down quarks is minus two-thirds, plus an up quark was just plus two-thirds, so the neutron is electrically neutral. And similarly, the pion, pi plus, is an up quark and an anti-down quark. And quarks are just like everything else. When you go to the antiparticle, the electric charge reverses, so the d-bar quark has a charge of plus a third. You add that to plus two-thirds, and you get one, and so forth. Now, these vertical columns are known as families. So these are the particles in family one. These are the particles in family two. And these are the particles in family three. And so far as we know, that's all the families that there are. There are three families. And frankly, we don't understand why there are three families. It's a very interesting question. These particles in the first two rows are called leptons, which I think is just the Greek word for light. There are the charged leptons and the neutrinos, the neutral ones. And these in the last two rows are known as the quarks. Now, I think I should not take the time to explain why, but in the very, very successful so-called standard model of the elementary particles, which has these as ingredients, as among the basic ingredients, you can't violate CP in a big way except in a process in which either leptons or else quarks from all three families are involved. That's the rule. So let us see how that applies here. If I now write down one of these processes, but indicating for you the quark content, the K long, which way do I want to say this, is a strange quark and an anti-down quark. And it decays to a pi plus, which, as I mentioned before, is an up quark and an anti-down quark, and then an electron and a neutrino, an anti-neutrino. This involves the leptons from generation number, family number one only. And these are quarks or anti-quarks from family number one. And here, the strange quark is from family number two, but family number three is absent. This process does not involve either the quarks or the leptons from all three families. And the rule is, whenever that's the case, CP is not going to be violated by a lot, only by a little. And we understand in a mathematical way how that works out. I will not take the time to go through that. Therefore, if you want to have a hope of seeing big CP violating effects, big asymmetries between the behavior of a particle and an antiparticle, you have to go look at a process which involves all three families. And in the last roughly 4 years, that has finally been done with new machines that make it possible. And let me tell you about the result. So what these new machines study is processes like the decay of a B0 particle, which is yet another particle like the bion and the gaon. It's made of quarks, like all of them. In particular, it's made of an anti-B quark, the antiparticle of that, and a down quark. And the process they study is where this goes, for only the briefest instant, into a bound state of a top quark and an anti-top quark, and then into the antiparticle of the original, a B without the bar and a D now with the bar. And then this guy disintegrates into a K short, which is related to this K long, has the same quark content basically, but has a shorter lifetime. The same quark content as before. And another particle called a psi. The names of these particles don't matter. What's important here is the quark content, just the quark content. Now look at this. B, T are in family number 3. D is in family number 1. S is in family number 2. So is C, all three families involved. Consequently, as far as our understanding goes, here, the behavior of a particle and its antiparticle could be very different. Now, what they do is they study this decay, and then they study the exact same decay where everywhere there's no bar, put one, and everywhere there is one, erase it. So we start from B0 bar, like this, and blah, blah, blah. All the same as before, but every particle replaced by its antiparticle. And then you compare with above. And what is found is that the rate for B0 bar decay, that is this whole decay chain, but with B replaced by B bar as the initial starting point, and the rate for the process I explicitly wrote out, differ by approximately a factor of 7. So now an antiparticle and a particle are behaving very different. And it's the B bar decay rate, which is faster, much faster. Like this? No, you don't. So how do we know it did that? How do we explain Feynman diagrams? You know, energy is conserved except when it's not, which is to say, there is something called the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics, and it says that momentum can be violated, energy can be violated, and that the complementarity between energy and something else is between energy and time. So energy can be violated, energy conservation, but for a very short time. A very short time, I mean, very tiny fraction of a second. We do not see this. The way we know that this occurs is that we can, using the field theory, write amplitudes for this to turn into that via this as an intermediate state. And if we try that hypothesis, we get what are numerically successful descriptions of what we see. That does not necessarily prove the pudding. It could be that something else is going on and we have been fooled. That is, in fact, still open. No one has actually seen this. They do see the initial state turning into the final state. That they see. That this is happening in between, is purely conjectural at this, well, it's not purely conjectural. Pardon?
It doesn't change the conclusion.
It would certainly not change the conclusion. This is an observation. The reason I went through this was to motivate that we wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that these two decay rates are very unequal. And they are very unequal. However, what is needed, as David says, what in the end, what is needed is a big difference. And there is a big difference.
But since zero bar can go directly to this final state, zero.
Yes, yes. The discussion wouldn't change very much if we just did that. There is the possibility of a backwards going arrow as well.
And then another arrow to the bottom.
That's right. All of those things are possible. But by one mechanism or another, B goes to this final state, and a very important role is played, we believe, by what is called particle-antiparticle mixing, that is, this going into its anti or this backwards. However, for our purposes, you're absolutely right. This doesn't matter. What matters is that B goes to this final state. And then I can have B bar going to this, the ante of this final state, which happens to be this final state also, because as you see, when I replace C bar by C bar C, nothing changes. And the two decay rates are unequal, very unequal. That's the important point, this one.
It seems like they mix at a, must mix at a rate faster than the final decay.
Absolutely.
So how does one, we're oscillating back and forth, and how do you know which particle you have?
If you want to ask which, how we know which particle we have, that gets us into an extremely interesting discussion of Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen correlations. Let's do that offline. how do you know which particle you have? Yes, yes, yes. Very, very briefly. These B mesons are made in pairs. They're made in an electron-positron collision, and out comes a B pair, one going one way, one going the other way. They are in a P wave, and as a result of the symmetry properties of a P wave, they have correlated properties. You observe the decay of one of them, not into a final state like this, but into a final state which reveals whether the parent was a B or a B bar, and that tells you by EPR correlations the nature of the other guy. Mm-hmm. That's how it's actually done. And it's a very interesting example of the subtleties of quantum mechanics actually being put here to a very important use. Okay. Now, in order for us to survive, it has to be the case that somehow there's a preponderance of matter over antimatter. For that preponderance to have developed, we needed matter and antimatter to behave differently. Here we see that they do behave differently. They behave very differently. So are we done? No. Because it turns out that this CP violation acting in the early universe is insufficient. And let me explain why that is in a hand-waving way. The early universe was a very hot place. What that means is that the average energy per particle was very high. That's all heat means. High temperature means the average energy is high. Now, of course, Einstein taught us that mass and energy are just different aspects of the same thing. So I can compare how big the energy is relative to the mass of a particle. And early enough in the universe, when it was very hot, the energy was much bigger than the mass of a particle. Now, you remember these quarks, U, C, T, D, S, B, family 1, family 2, family 3, and we need all three of them to get something like this. The difference between these families is that mass goes this way. This is light, this is heavier still, and similarly here. So the difference between one family and another is how much the particles weigh. In the early universe, the temperatures were so high that the masses were negligible compared to the energies which the individual quarks had. But when the masses are negligible, you cannot tell the difference between an up quark, a charm quark, or a top quark, because the only difference is that one weighs more than the other. And when the energies are sufficiently large, that's irrelevant, and you no longer have a handle which will tell you the difference between a quark in one family and a quark in another. Consequently, in the early universe, you can't know. There is no way to know whether all three families are present in some physical process or not. And the result of that is that CP violation disappears in the early universe. You can see it in the laboratory today when the universe is not so hot. But the same physics which leads to this big CP violation today could not have done so in the early universe. So we are not done. So now what?
I have a question. How do you distinguish neutrinos? When you distinguish the quarks by mass, how do you distinguish neutrinos?
So let's turn to the neutrinos. Also by mass. The neutrinos weigh very, very little, but not zero, and that's one of the very interesting discoveries of just the last 5 years. So you can also distinguish them, if you have a good enough scale, by mass. So let us turn to the neutrinos. We want to understand why there's much more matter than antimatter. Thinking about the quarks didn't answer the question. So let's look at the neutrinos. What are neutrinos? They are part of this table, which I have erased. And then there's the neutrinos down there. These are microscopic particles, just like the quarks and the charged leptons. However, first interesting point is that, as we said at the very beginning, we are made of electrons, protons, and neutrons, and the protons and neutrons are in turn made of quarks. We are not made of neutrinos, but if you ask not about what we're made of, but about the universe as a whole, neutrinos are approximately a billion times more abundant than any of these particles. So they're about 10 to the ninth nus per E or P or N. These neutrinos were made like everything else in the Big Bang, and they're still there. So what are some interesting numbers? In the space occupied by one person, about 30 million neutrinos. I'll write this as number of neutrinos per cubic person. At any given time, yes. I mean, they're all over. They're in space. And they interact with stuff very, very feebly. So when you move from one place to another, you leave the neutrinos that were there behind, and you pick up another 30 million. You got 30 million.
While they're moving.
In addition, power plants generate neutrinos, including the big power plant in the sky. So from the sun. Approximately 10 to the 14 news passing through each person here on Earth per second. This is the number of neutrinos through you per second. Don't worry, they are not carcinogenic.
They are, but just not at a very high rate.
They are not significantly carcinogenic. Yeah.
Since we don't know their mechanism for cancer.
Okay, let's worry. In any case, they're there. So the question is, do neutrinos violate CP conservation, CP invariance? And if they do, is the CP violation among neutrinos or something related to it the reason for the matter excess over antimatter? Is this CP violation why we are here? Now, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago in response to your question, although neutrinos are very, very light compared to all the other things like the quarks and the charged leptons, the proton, the neutron, etc., it has been established now very, very convincingly, but only within the last 5 years, that neutrinos have non-zero masses. Consequently, the neutrinos appear to be particles very similar to the quarks, which also have non-zero masses. The quarks violate CP, so quite possibly the neutrinos do too. And we're gearing up, I think gets the timetable wrong, but experiments are being planned to look for CP violation among the neutrinos. And let me describe to you what the CP violation would look like. Here's how neutrinos could potentially violate CP. This is schematic, but this is the logic of the experiment. You have some charged lepton, like a mu minus, for example, coming into a region where it interacts to make a neutrino. The neutrino propagates some distance. And then it strikes a detector. And you look for events in which the neutrino interacts in the detector and it makes, let us say, an electron. And now you do the same thing, but with every particle replaced by its antiparticle. So you replace the incoming particle by a mu plus. There is still this interaction region. When mu pluses are coming in instead of mu minuses, where this is a neutrino, this is going to be an antineutrino. And now there's a...
You're going to explain why you don't need an anti-detector. An anti-target.
Anti-director?
I'm not going there. And now this is a positron coming out. Well, you don't need an anti-interaction region here because actually you can generate the neutrino or the antineutrino just through the decay, the disintegration of the pairing. Here, if you were to make a strict matter-antimatter comparison, you would have to replace the detector by an anti-detector. That's absolutely true. So here we make use of our knowledge of how these particles interact in matter relative to how they would interact in antimatter. We know both of those things from experiments that we've done, and that enables us to deduce what would happen if we had an anti-detector here from measurements with a detector, not an anti-detector. But you're absolutely right. In principle, I won't erase it. It should be like that. Okay. Now, what you do is you compare the rate at which this happens, or if you like, the probability for it, with the corresponding rate for the anti-process. And what you're looking for is a difference in those rates. And schematically, this is what people are going to do. Not next week, but when the facilities that are necessary to do such experiments have been built. So the question is, are the rates different? And given what we've already seen in the quark sector, there's a very good chance that they are. Now, what's this got to do with the early universe? The neutrinos, as we've said, are very, very light. The best, at least the most popular, attempt to understand why they are so light is something which is called the seesaw mechanism. The seesaw mechanism says that the light neutrinos have super heavy partners. It predicts that. These are partners to the neutrinos. And they are called n, the first one, the second one, the third one, maybe more. And the way the seesaw mechanism works, the heavier the n's get, the lighter the neutrinos get. That's the reason for the name seesaw. But, I mean, it's not just hand waving. There is a mathematical model. And in that model, the mass of the super heavy and the mass of the neutrino are correlated in this way. But a very important prediction is the existence of these heavy partners. Now, these heavy partners do not exist today in nature, but like everything else, they would have been made in the hot Big Bang when the temperature was sufficiently high, that the energies were sufficiently large, that you had enough energy to make even a very heavy particle like one of these. Now, these heavies, n, are related to the neutrinos through this seesaw partnership. And if it turns out that the neutrinos violate CP invariance in this way, then there's a good chance that the decays of these heavy particles do too. And the way that would work is like this. Suppose I have a heavy n made in the early universe. It soon disintegrates, and it can do that in two ways. The same particle can disintegrate in one of two ways. It makes either an electron plus a positively charged particle that I will call the Higgs, but its exact significance is not the point here. Or this same particle disintegrates into a positron plus a Higgs minus. And as we discussed in the decays of x plus the proton and x minus the proton, if CP invariance holds, these two decay rates must be equal. But if CP is violated, then it can happen that these two rates, which are for two processes with every particle replaced by its antiparticle, the n is its own antiparticle here, can differ. And if they differ, then even if you start with a universe which is matter-antimatter symmetric, you will generate unequal numbers of electrons and positrons. And a symmetry between E minus and E plus. Now, of course, we're not interested in an asymmetry only between E minus and E plus. We want also the number of nucleons, protons and neutrons, bigger than the number of their antiparticles. This does not do that. It generates only an asymmetry between electron and positron. But then the very, very successful standard model, as it's called, of what elementary particles do predicts that if you have an asymmetry between electrons and positrons, some of that asymmetry will be processed as the universe evolves into the generation of an asymmetry between protons, neutrons on the one hand, and antiprotons, antineutrons on the other. So in this two-step process, you can get numbers of electrons, neutrons, and protons bigger than the numbers of their antiparticles. Now, of course, we cannot repeat the early universe. That's not a feasible experiment. The most that we can do today is what has been called scientific archaeology. That is, you look at the particles which are here today as a result of the evolution of the universe, and they include the neutrinos, and you see if the properties of these particles which are here today and your understanding of how these particles might be related to particles present in the early universe gives you a basis for understanding the properties of the universe that you're trying to understand. So in this case, you look for CP violation among the neutrinos. If the neutrinos violate CP, that is, if neutrinos and antineutrinos behave differently, then quite possibly these rates could have been different, generating an E minus E plus asymmetry, which can then be reprocessed into the asymmetry we see today.
How heavy is heavy?
Heavy can be anywhere from 10 to the 10, 10 to the 12 GeV, up to 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 GeV. GeV means the mass of a proton. Very heavy. You're not going to make them with an accelerator.
What is the relation between CP violation on the left-hand side and CP violation in the middle?
The relation...
Can we see no CP violation?
I understand. In principle, the CP violation which you would see today and the CP violation which occurred in the early universe are different quantities, and their relation is quite complicated. It can happen that one of them is zero and the other is not zero either way, but that is rather unlikely. I mean, if you actually look, there are people in the room who are exploring that very, very question. If you actually look at the way it works, by far the likely thing is if you see one, the other is present. Fair?
Yes.
The expert is sitting there. So let me try to sum up this story. We avoid getting annihilated because, although the universe contains the matter of which we are made, it contains essentially zero antimatter. However, for this asymmetry between matter and antimatter to have developed, assuming that it was a symmetric universe at the beginning, matter and antimatter must behave differently from one another. That difference is called CP violation. Now, we have confirmed by laboratory experiments that nature does violate CP, at least the quarks do. But quark CP violation is insufficient to explain the origin of a matter-antimatter asymmetry early in the universe when things were hot and there's no difference between a heavy quark and a less heavy quark. So CP violation goes away. Consequently, we turn our attention... Well, they don't claim that quark CP violation in the standard model can do so. They claim that perhaps phases in supersymmetry might be able to do so. And that's an open possibility too, but that requires that you move to what I think is not unfairly described as a corner of parameter space. It's possible, though. But because the neutrinos are thought to have these heavy partners which could have played a role in the universe, a lot of people are looking at this possibility that the neutrinos violate CP, and that very likely, therefore, there could have been this CP violation in the early universe, producing the dominance of matter over antimatter in making life possible. Thank you.
For genesis to give prior genesis, you also need unified unification. So there's another big ingredient here, which, since you've been so careful and non-speculative, is required.
Yeah, yes.
Didn't remark on, namely, you need an extension we all believe in, the standard model.
But it is needed.
Unified leptons and
no, that's right.
You don't need that. I mean, because you get the variance from the leptons at the weak scale.
No,
the
that's scale not enough.
Once you have the leptons, you get the variance. Absolutely, because B minus L is.
Yeah.
No, so you don't need.
He means failure on processes.
You don't need the variance.
You may get it.
No, no. You sure? If you have the leptons, you surely get them converting to variance. You don't need any. You don't need CP. Leptons.
The lore is that that's in fact true, what Joe was saying. Yeah, it's failure on processes at and before the electroweak phase transition.
Are there reliable calculations with spherons? I mean, there's no quantitative calculation. I mean,
yeah, the nature of the question is, are there reliable calculations of that which is non-perturbative and therefore non-calculable?
Well, there are lattice calculations here.
Well, I think it's fair to say yes, that's very hard. Yes?
How close are we to being able to predict from measurements today the 10 to the 10th photons per baryon in processes like this?
Would you like to?
As close as we were with the previous theory, which Boris has indicated is dead.
Was that the answer?
I think so. No, but you're asking about something else.
Small. Yeah.
But we don't know how big this is.
Well, that's my question. I mean, what measurements today will determine those constants and those decays? How close are we?
What measurements today will determine the parameters that govern these decays? The hope is that not only will you have measurements in the neutrino sector, but you will learn other things as a result of experiments at the energy frontier, discovering supersymmetry, things of this kind, that tell you a lot more about the relations between the heavy sector and the light sector than we know today. I mean, today it is, in fact, quite speculative. That's fair. Well, and what measurements? I'm not sure.
Does it
but
quantitatively, if you put in 10 to the 11 GV and maximal mixing, maximal CP violation by minimum? Numbers
do come out in the ballpark, but if the question is, can you evade being in the ballpark at the moment, the answer is still yes. I mean, there's a lot that we're going to have to know that we don't know. It is possible to have, I mean, you give me a relationship between CP violation in these two sectors, and if I'm diabolical, I can diddle with it until I've totally distorted the relationship. That's not impossible. If there are accidental cancellations in the one sector but not in the other sector. However, again, you know, as we discover other things, things that are possible today will have to be discarded. That's the hope.
Are you saying that these ends are sufficiently massive that in the early universe it was possible to distinguish them and therefore CP violation would result in antimatter and matter symmetry?
Yes, yes, yes.
Unlike quarks.
Yes.
10 to the 12
GeV. There's another effect which I hesitate to mention, but let me mention it. Just between you and me. The kind of CP violation that is necessary to make these two decay rates different, unlike what happens in the quark case, does not go away when the masses become degenerate. That actually is a bit of a surprise. In fact, when I first saw it not so many months ago, I thought I must have made a mistake in the calculation. But I didn't.
And is CPT violation ever seen?
Is CPT violation ever seen? Nobody for sure has ever seen it. There is speculation that the neutrinos weigh like this and the antineutrinos weigh like that. CPT is the invariance that says that a particle is always accompanied by an antiparticle and that they weigh precisely the same. If CPT is violated, then, I mean, worst case violation is one particle exists and the other doesn't. Lesser CPT violation is they're both there, but they have different masses. There are people who speculate that this is going on. This is a neutrino and this is an antineutrino. But we know we have no evidence that's going on.
Does string theory unambiguously predict CPT at low energies?
I'm sorry?
Does string theory unambiguously predict CPT at low energies?
Joe, does string theory unambiguously? No, I think
no,
the answer
but
is
there,
no.
There are claims that it predicts the opposite. Those are surely not justified. Those are wildly speculative.
All of its realizations that so far it predicts CPT.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same. And the tests of CPT are extraordinary, where we can't test them.
Yes and no.
By biological standards. Or even condensed matter.
I have no comment on either of these comparisons.
they're very precise tests. We understand, as you say, that it could be violated in a big way in other sectors.
Exactly.
In the sectors
exactly.
That existed.
Fair enough.
Absolutely remarkable.
Fair enough. We know that here, CPT violation is very small, but it could be big there.
But the evidence for direct T violation is also not.
Direct T violation?
Yeah.
True.
I mean, the direct evidence for T
true.
Also
true. What we know is that CP is certainly violated.
But not T.
It's possible to come back to the repeats and analogy with chirality in the biological world, because I mean, many people think that the fact that parity is broken has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that you see only chiral molecules in the biology. So, yeah.
Is it true that chiral molecules replicate their chirality?
So
once you had a breaking of the symmetry in one direction, it always stays in that direction. Is that the way it works?
Is it possible that some mechanism like that is at work here, or is it excluding?
It's called Atherton baryogenesis. The common sub just develops one phasor, sign of the phasor.
Yeah, you cut out a bubble, but then you would expect the man.
No. That happens on super horizon scales at the end of the equation.
Oh, you have domains, but they're the next one is outside the universe. Okay, see, he's talking about your model.
Why does it have to be on the super horizon scale? Why can't it be in the next planetary system where life could have evolved that way?
No, he's talking about CP.
Well, he's talking about
CP
domain. CP. Oh, not the chirality of RNA or something.
Well, this is a wonderful lecture. Let's thank Joris.